Okay, well, I'd like to welcome you all to the McKinley Oration. This oration coincides with the 7th annual conference of the Otago International Health Research Network. And this meeting's taking place today and tomorrow right here in the Hutton Theatre. So those of you who've been at the meeting today, welcome back. And for members of public and others who've joined us just for the oration, you're very welcome. So this oration is named for the McKinley family, who generously endowed the chair at the Centre for International Health that I currently hold, so I'm particularly thankful, and I'd just like to acknowledge their assistance. The McKinley oration this year will be delivered by Professor Jakob Jinstag. Jakob is Professor of Epidemiology and Head of the Human and Animal Health Unit at the Swiss Tropical and Public Health Institute. He's also the current president of the International Association for Ecology and Health. Jakob graduated with a doctorate in veterinary medicine focused on salmonella diagnosis from the University of Bern in 1986, and also has a PhD in tropical animal production from the Prince Leopold Institute of Tropical Medicine, Antwerp, Belgium. He's worked in rural practice, also as a postdoctoral fellow on trypanosomiasis research at the Swiss Tropical and Public Health Institute. From 1990 to the end of 1993, he led a livestock helminthosis project at the University of Bern at the International Trypanotolerance Centre in the Gambia. From 1994 to 1998, he directed the Centre Suisse de Recherche Scientifique in Abidjan, Côte d'Ivoire. And since 1998, he's led a research group at the Swiss Tropical and Public Health Institute in Basel on the interface of human and animal health, with a particular focus on the health of nomadic people and the control of zoonoses in developing countries under the paradigm of One Health, which is the theme of this year's meeting. Jakob's a diplomat of the European College of Veterinary Public Health, a member of the Scientific Advisory Board of the Prince Leopold Institute of Tropical Medicine, and a member of the Transdisciplinary Board of the Swiss Academy of Sciences. Jakob is a world authority on One Health and on zoonoses in low-resource areas, and we're really delighted that he's travelled to Dunedin this week to be with us. I'd like you to join me in warmly welcoming Jakob to speak on the topic of One Health, the added value of closer cooperation of human and veterinary medicine. Welcome, Jakob.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a great privilege for me to be here, and I would like to thank John Crump for having invited me. And I would also like to thank Fiona Gray to help me organize everything. And of course, the McKinley family for having sponsored my 42-hour trip, my longest ever trip I did in my travel history to New Zealand. It's also my first time I'm here in New Zealand, and I'm very impressed and have seen penguins yesterday, which I haven't seen in my life, except in the zoo. So I would like to talk to you today about One Health. And you see it already in the title. I deliberately call it the added value of closer cooperation of human and veterinary medicine. If you don't take anything home today, then please take the word added value home, because I would like to define it very much like that and show you hopefully enough evidence to convince you. So we are an interdisciplinary research group at the Swiss Tropical and Public Health Institute in Basel. That's the place here in northern Switzerland. So this spot here is Basel in Switzerland. It's at the border with France on the left side and Germany. You can have breakfast in Germany, lunch in France, and go home for dinner all by bike. And my work on One Health really started with working with mobile pastoralists. This is one of the foci of our research. And we moved then into the control of zoonotic diseases in developing countries. And I would very much like to say, clearly One Health extends also to non-communicable disease. We know that people who have dogs are less obese and less depressed. And we also currently use animal therapy for brain damaged people. And there is a huge range of opportunities of One Health in non-communicable diseases. My examples are more from health service provision and, of course, from zoonotic diseases today. But just that you know, I don't forget that aspect. So we are part of larger networks where we worked also together with many other disciplines in development research. This one was funded by the Swiss National Science Foundation and the Swiss Corporation. This was quite unique that a National Science Foundation and a Development Corporation joined forces for such programs. We are also part of Wellcome Trust-funded Afrique One Network on capacity building and the EU-funded ICONS Network. We are mostly in West and Central Africa, Horn of Africa, Central Asia, and a little bit in Vietnam. So, speaking about a closer cooperation between human and animal health requires some historical, cultural and philosophical reflections. We cannot just go into the heart of the topic. We have to look a little bit back and we have to look a little bit across our own fence of culture. And then I will concentrate on theoretical aspects, methods, but then spend most of the time on examples to show you what it really means, and then look beyond One Health. We have already looked beyond One Health in the earlier session and give you an outlook. All what I tell you, you can find it from March onwards in a textbook that we are currently publishing, and what I bring you is also some extracts from there, also to tease you, of course. The whole book starts with this chapter on One Health in history, and interestingly, the question is, how can we speak about the history of something that is barely 15 years old? The term One Health, I wonder if you find the earliest publication using that term. I would claim it is probably 2005. It's not older. But doctors and veterinarians have worked together since centuries. And again, the Chinese are the earliest, as with the paper and the powder. They had already in the Zhou dynasty, I don't express it correctly, but they had already a public health system that included veterinarians. And what these authors emphasize is we should not see One Health as just a lineage of personal achievements. It is much more part of broader movements. And these things started already in the pre-modern situation times where animals were studied to understand the human body. In those days, all was the joint paradigm was humoralism, the learning of the different juices of the body, and really disciplines came up with the Arabs. I mean, they had textbooks on horse medicine. The Kitab al-Baitara is an Arabic textbook on horse medicine. In Europe, the veterinary medicine remained in the hands of the equerries, of those people who dealt with the horses, whereas human medicine entered the newly created universities in the 16th century as a faculty of the artes technicae, not of the artes liberales. They were not allowed to belong to law and theology. It is often attributed to Christianism that we would separate between humans and animals. Whereas Christianism is rather co-creational. I would argue that the separation of humans and animals came with rationalist thinking, mostly with Descartes, among others, and with the empirism where this divide between humans and animals was made. But this was again overthrown by the systematicians. Linnaeus, who established the first systematics of species, could show that the great apes and humans are actually quite close, and he challenged that. And we can also find this as the beginning of comparative medicine in the 18th century, especially around the French scientist Vicq d'Azyr. The first veterinary schools were created in 1762 in Lyon and followed with a massive explosion of creation of veterinary schools and established veterinary medicine as an own profession, which contributed, of course, also to the separation of the disciplines. But links persisted. We have the great time of the comparative anatomy, but also germ theory, the finding that under the microscope, cells of humans and animals and bacteria look the same. And I just mentioned Virchow, who stated in the Prussian Senate about bovine TB that both medicines should not be looked at separately. Both should contribute to the solving of this problem. Not to forget also the theory of evolution, which reinforced the point of Linnaeus that humans and animals are not so separate as we think. But then was, of course, an increase in competition over research and policy. So food safety, does it belong to public health or does it belong to animal health? This debate influenced very much the formation of modern administrations. And while many, many doctors were involved in studying animals, using animals in experimental surgery, but also in physiology, in the late 19th and early 20th century, they used a lot of different animal species. But there has been a strange trend, probably necessary trend of standardization. Today, whatever we do, we look at it in a mouse, which is actually a strange thing. Mouse immunology is not human immunology. But this standardization is ongoing. I'm just walking out of a course in animal testing, which I need to do our work on animal-assisted therapy. But what is also very interesting is the inversion of the role of animal models. Animal experimental testing goes into humans, and in humans it goes into large-scale trials, and suddenly flows back. For example, the modern surgical therapies have initially been developed in animals, are tested in humans, and go back into advanced knee surgery or hip surgery in animals, or even cardiac surgery in animals. After the Second World War, there was definitely a renewed call for unifying medicine as one medicine as part of a broader momentum. We will come back to Schwabe in a while, but we should also mention here the Rockefeller Foundation, the US Bureau of Animal Industry with Raus and Schopp. It is actually Peyton Raus who discovered the first cancer gene in chicken. And that influenced the whole cancer genetics in humans after that. We should not forget Carl F. Meyer, the director of the Hooper Institute, who discovered the horse encephalitis virus as a vet, but who introduced the first public health course in the United States. And then the foundation of veterinary public health at the CDC by Steele, where Steele used not so much his technical but his very diplomatic skills of making arranging things in a way that the medics took up the concept of veterinary public health, which he, as a veterinarian, could not have promoted in the same way. And today, veterinary public health is probably one of the best institutionalized concepts with departments in the WHO. But WHO and FAO and OIE, the World Animal Health Organization, they also started to work together under Kaplan. And this was strongly pushed then with the advent of the avian influenza, SARS and BSE crisis. And an interesting push for One Health came from conservation. The conservationists who look after the maintenance of lions and tigers and giraffes understood that they can sustain these conservation areas only if humans and animals are in good health around the conservation areas. So the One World, One Health concept was even trademarked. I'm not fond of trademarking these kind of things, but it is worth mentioning that the conservation of animals was a strong contributor to One Health thinking. And of course, this was then fostered with avian influenza, SARS, BSE, and today Ebola. We heard it this morning. As an anecdote, I can tell you that I was evacuating the first European patient to Switzerland in 1994 who got ill from Ebola from exposure to a chimpanzee, a dead chimpanzee from which he took samples. So we should not forget the game-animal link. Bats are certainly very important. I don't spend more time about Ebola now. Let us move on to Calvin Schwabe, who brought it to the point with his statement that there should not be a difference in paradigm between human and veterinary medicine in his famous book, Veterinary Medicine and Human Health. Calvin Schwabe was influenced for his this thinking by his work with Dinka pastoralists, which he considered as an integrated society because they lived with their animals, especially cattle, in a very, very integrated way. I come back to it later. But interestingly, that helped us, of course, in our work with pastoralists. Calvin Schwabe was also drawing a very nice concept figure, where he drew zoology as a big cylinder, of which anthropology was just the first slice. And then animal husbandry and wildlife were other parts. And then that piece of cake, that big piece of general medicine, of which human medicine was also just one part. I like it particularly because it shows also the close linkage between medicine and anthropology. I will also come back to it later. Clearly, we don't need only the linkage of human and animal health. We need to strongly connect with anthropology and ecology to solve today's complex problems, as we heard earlier. But let me spend also a little bit of time about cultural differences and the influence of culture, because if we speak about human and animal health, we have inevitably to think about our own relation to animals. And we have to understand that this relationship we have with animals is different in different contexts. And if we work across cultures, we have to consider that very much so. I believe that domestication of animals was one of the most important steps for human development and culture as such, because suddenly there was an abundance of food in a way that was not achievable just by hunting. And hunting was way too dangerous and too difficult to find enough food to nourish large populations. I would say without domestication, we would not have achieved urbanization. You can think about urban centers only with domesticated livestock. And when we deal with animals, we can no longer just do it without any values. We have to value them somehow. They can be our companions in as much as we would consider them as pests, in as much as we would consider them as food. And these normative aspects have to be considered in our work. They will directly influence the way we do an economic analysis, for example. And I would like here just to make the quick link. I don't need to spend a lot of time, that we have to factor in here the environment, the social ecological system. I would like to refer to the famous paper by Elinor Ostrom, the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2009, I guess, who unfortunately died. But she strongly pushed the point of considering the social ecological system as a basic unit in which you would study health just as one component. I talked to Elinor Ostrom 2008 and asked her if she had thought about health as a component of social ecological systems, and she said she didn't think about it. And we even planned a book chapter, but unfortunately she died in 2009. But where Ostrom was very strong was she, and that's why she got the Nobel Prize in economics, she developed a model, an economic model that is between capitalism and socialism. It is the small community engagement, which means one of the key examples is the lobster fishing in Maine, where local communities manage their own natural resources of lobster fishing and control each other mutually. And in this way, they can sustain the production of lobster if they don't overfish it. And she believes very much that we can manage our resources better than distant central state governments can do that by letting them be managed by smaller communities. And I emphasize this here because this is also our experience in our work in One Health, that we must engage with the public as scientists. I will show more examples, and we do this in a way by bringing together authorities and the communities. If you talk only to the communities alone, they will blame the government. If you talk only to the government, they will blame the community. But if you bring them together, they can no longer blame each other. And as scientists, you will only play a moderating role and allow them to negotiate the solutions. And Ostrom is here absolutely a guiding principle. That's why I emphasize it here. And I think also that One Health has probably the strongest leverage in solving practical societal problems. EcoHealth came out of an academic conceptual thinking, but whereas One Health was much more pushed by practical problem solving like BSE or avian influenza. To continue the normative aspects, again, we sometimes consider animals as intimate companions. On the other side, they have only financial value for their meat. I was very surprised when I saw a dog trader in Mali driving his bike with 6 dogs behind, which he would sell on the market close to Mopti for $12 a piece. I didn't think that this was such a big business in a Muslim country like Mali. But there is a high cultural diversity, again, an example of contextual understanding. What bothers us, of course, very much is that we would consider animals as prey, but animals would consider us also as prey. And This has led to large extinction of predators by humans. I must confess that in the Gambia we had a python in the garden and we had two small babies, and I killed that python. I'm sorry for it. But it's this deep-seated fear of being prey. And the sad reality is that we maximize our profits on livestock with very little regard to humane standard. I would argue that humane treatment of animals is an unfinished agenda, and we must continue that on all lines. And if we don't continue with that, business will always neglect the humane standards. But we should not forget also that livestock keeping is also an important way out of the poverty trap for about 800 million small-scale farmers. To keep their few pigs or their few chicken or their few sheep is life-saving for them. So we are torn between these maximization and livelihood issues. And several states have started today to consider animals no longer as commodities. In Swiss law now, animals are no longer considered as commodity, as Sache. They are in between, but they don't have also personal rights. But that's an important step. Let us just look very briefly, and then I will stop that chapter, into different cultures. The ancient Egyptians considered themselves really and their cattle as one flock of God. They had a similarly co-creational attitude as you would find it in the Bible or in the Quran. In the Old Testament, animals and humans were created on the same day, which emphasizes that co-creational attitude, which we still find very much in Fulani or in Dinka ways of thinking. We can also argue that the modern animal welfare movement was strongly influenced by southern German pietism, to which I would also group partially at least Albert Schweitzer with his thinking about reverence for life, Ehrfurcht vor dem Leben. What I want to emphasize with all these examples is that we should not forget the very important Indian component, or with Hinduism, but also with Buddhist thinking, where you would do as little harm as possible, but also that thinking of metempsychosis or reincarnation, where there is a double identity. You can be born as an animal and you can be born as a human. This is strange to many, but it's a reality to millions of people. And we should not forget that the large free-ranging dog populations in India who result in the highest toll on rabies worldwide is because of that, among others, because of this attitude that you would feed dogs in the street. You would never do that in Africa. In Africa, you would not find so much food in the street for dogs. Here, I don't want to value at all these different thinkings. I want to emphasize that they determine how people react on animals and on humans. What is important is that we keep a self-reflexive attitude. We should first of all know what is our own attitude towards animals, what is our own religious and cultural background, to help us to understand when we work in an intercultural context, how is it for the others? How do our partners think? I would not eat a dog, frankly, but in Vietnam, dog consumption is common, and so on. But this is important for the methods where we come now, because we need methods to link human and animal health. But first of all, we can ask, why do we need actually that doctors and veterinarians should better collaborate? And I give you just two examples. The most contemporary example is the Q fever outbreak in Netherlands in 2007, I think. They had when the Dutch raise animals, they do it very intensively. And they had farms with over 10,000 goats, and suddenly they had massive Q fever outbreaks. And this was not reported to the public health system. And the public health the Dutch public health system complained that they were not informed by the veterinary system. So there is a delay in the detection of new disease from a lack of communication. Similarly, in outbreaks of Rift Valley fever in Mauritania, they were misdiagnosed as yellow fever until it was discovered that there was an ongoing Rift Valley fever outbreak. The last massive Rift Valley fever outbreak in Kenya was first discovered by the public health, which is the latest stage of the transmission chain. The veterinary surveillance was very poor at this time, and they didn't discover it actually first. So, by our over-specialization and by our living in different silos or in different offices, different departments, if we don't talk to each other, we miss out on the health of our animals or on our people. So, but if we argue for a better collaboration, there should be an added value. And here I come to that key slide, I would argue. If you don't keep anything of what I have been saying tonight, keep that slide in mind. Recognizing that humans and animals are intimately interlinked with their environment is an absolute necessary requirement. And a lot of talks that we have heard today nicely showed this interlinkage. And that is very important that we understand it. But I would call it only then one health if we can show that we can produce an added value from this closer collaboration. And I would call this as a sufficient requirement. And we need specific methods that allow us to work out this added value. We need, for example, joint human and animal survey designs. Today, we have seen a fantastic human and animal survey design from Afghanistan. Or we need to have methods to develop joint health services in special circumstances. Or we need cross-sector transmission models between animals and humans. Or, of course, cross-sector economic analysis. In the forthcoming examples that I will give you, I will mention these methods, and I will mention more methods as we go. The first example comes from these mobile pastoralists. These are examples from Chad, where we work with these camel nomads on the left side. These people, they walk about 400 kilometers a year in perpetual search for water and fodder for their animals. These are Fulani pastoralists, also on Lake Chad. The cow is very cold, so the boy made her a fire. No, it's not the cold weather, it's the insects, and the cows like to stand in these smoke because it keeps the flies away. And these people have basically no healthcare. They have no schools, they have no security, they are void of social service provision. And this was the point of departure of our work. And something special happened in the course of our work, that was the revolution of the mobile communication. Today, even most of these pastoralists have mobile communication. Here we explain to them how to use a solar charger for their cell phone. Even this lady has a cell phone hanging in the tree to have a better reception. And we have to use this mobile communication in all the research we do, because that's a new reality. They would never have a landline, actually. And I just put here also a citation about the importance for their animals and their children. They mentioned that For the animals, they are in charge, but for the children, it's God. So there is a clear separation of responsibilities. They have also quite an understanding on medical concepts. If you look a little bit closer at this cow here, she has a keloid on her nose, and that's a local way of vaccinating against contagious bovine pleuropneumonia. They just rub a piece of lung of a dead animal from pleuropneumonia on the nose, on a scarified nose, and in this way they can vaccinate the animal. Interestingly, the men have these notions, which is, this is age-old immunology, but they have no clue about the vaccination of their children. We work also with Kel Tamashek in North Mali, and here we could do this only thanks to a cultural scientist. This was a Swiss lady who was fluent in Arabic and Tamashek. She studied Oriental studies, and she lived months and months with these people, and these women told her all their stories. In parallel, we did a clinical survey on abortion and stillbirths and all the clinical aspects, and the numbers of stillbirths they reported to that cultural scientist were much more accurate than what we could record by a classical cross-sectional study. And this shows also the importance that we extend that close collaboration in such contexts also to the social and cultural sciences. And it shows you also the very, very harsh environment, which is about 100 kilometers north of Timbuktu, which is unfortunately today inaccessible because of the terrorist movements of Al-Qaeda. And here you see the hardship of access to health. This is the closest nurse who is based in a health center 60 kilometers away from these people treating a little girl. And another hardship is water. They have to dig out the water from 80 meters deep to drink all the waters. And in these situations, animals could not survive without humans. They need the humans to dig out the water for themselves. Once we had to pull out water because we wanted to wash, and I forgot the soap. So I went to the car to grab the soap, and when I came back, the donkey had emptied the trough. So in this situation, we created mixed teams of doctors and veterinarians going together, as you have done in Afghanistan, to study the health of humans and animals in the same time. And miraculously, they found that there were more animals vaccinated than children, among others. And before I come to these joint services, I would like to emphasize the importance that we didn't just go to these people like that. We had regular participatory stakeholder seminars where the communities and the authorities participated. So we had the decision makers. This is the chief veterinary officer of Chad. This is on the shores of Lake Chad. This is in North Mali. This is the chief medical officer of Timbuktu, the political authorities of Timbuktu, and the communities, and the scientists. As I said before, it is important that you assemble the most important stakeholders. You do a solid stakeholder analysis, otherwise you miss out on the solutions, and you create inequities that are hard to correct. But in these situations, we could identify very practical solutions which came up from the women or also from the chief medical officer, which we as scientists would not have found in that way on our desk. So with all these methods of joint teams, you have to bring together the disciplines, but you have to engage with the public and all the stakeholders. We could come up with joint healthcare provision. So when the veterinarians went out to vaccinate animals, they took along public health nurses who could then vaccinate children and women. They could also provide quality drugs, and they could also provide health education. So here is a clearly added value of this closer cooperation of humans and animals, because these children and women would otherwise not have access to this care. This does not work all the time. And 10 years after this study, the Chadian state has taken it up at borders. So when the nomadic pastoralists cross the border into Nigeria or Cameroon, they are vaccinated and their animals. So there is a practical uptake, and also the Ministry of Health has established now a directorate for pastoral health. And this here is just a repetition of what you have seen this morning. This is about joint human and animal study designs. Here we studied a representative prevalence of brucellosis in Kyrgyzstan in cattle, sheep, goat and humans. And we regressed then the human seroprevalence to the animal prevalence and could clearly show that sheep were the most important determinant of human brucellosis seropositivity. And we could confirm that with molecular biological studies from isolated strains from sheep. So by studying human and animal health in this kind of situations where there is a mutual influence, you create an added value by more quicker identification of the source of infection if you match the studies. Let us now go to Chad. Chad is in the heart of Africa, landlocked. Half of it is desert. And the capital city is N'Djamena. And personally, I never wanted to work on rabies, but we were asked by the Chadian partners if we could look into the rabies diagnosis. They did not have the standard immunofluorescence rabies diagnosis, and we agreed, but we said we want to do research. And we started off with an incidence study and a household survey on dog-humans, human relationship, and also small-scale vaccination trials where we could show that we could reach about 70% of the dogs, and only about 10% of the dogs were free-ranging, inaccessible. So knowing all this, I went to the Minister of Health and asked him, could you help us to vaccinate dogs to eliminate rabies in Chad? And he said, no, I'm in charge of the humans. I'm not dealing with dogs. So I went to the Minister of Agriculture and asked him, would you help me to vaccinate dogs to Would you help us to vaccinate dogs to interrupt rabies transmission? And he said, I'm looking after cattle, not after dogs. So I was deeply frustrated and asked myself the question, how can we prove that in the long run, the intervention in dogs is more profitable or more effective? And we had 6 years of weekly numbers of rabid dogs and of exposed humans. And we parameterized this dog-human, this is the dogs, the susceptible dogs, the rabid dogs who expose susceptible humans who become exposed or eventually rabid. We parameterized this model and simulated the transmission with and without dog mass vaccination. And from there we did the economics. And the economics look as this. If you keep just treating humans after their bite from a rabid dog, you have increasing cost. Every year about $7,000, that's the cost of the post-exposure vaccination. However, if you invest in dog mass vaccination, you have high initial cost, but that, I just need a little bit of water, that cost is not increasing massively because you interrupt transmission. And after 6 years, you come to break even. And from there onwards, the intervention in the dog is less costly than the intervention in the human. The added value in this exercise is that you can show where is the break even between an intervention oriented to the humans or an intervention in the reservoir host. You could not find this result if you studied only human rabies or only dog rabies. So you need One Health studies to show solutions for these kind of problems. And we did it. In 2012 and 2013, we vaccinated each about 20,000 dogs in Jamena, and transmission came nicely down after about 50% of the dogs have been vaccinated. And the last case was in January, and we had now 9 months free of dog rabies. We had now one more case in October. But we want to do the molecular biology to know if this is still the strain that of the clone that is ongoing transmission, or if it is reintroduced. But we could demonstrate, first of all, that a Chadian team of vaccinators was able to eliminate rabies from an African city. And most importantly, the Chadian state contributed the logistics and the personnel cost. And again, to what I said earlier, it is very important that in these partnerships there is equal footing, that each partner contributes. We contributed the vaccine and the research support, and the Chadian colleagues contributed the cost of the teams. And together we made it. And we are currently analyzing this, but we work on plans for a national elimination project. A further zoonosis example is here from Mongolia, where brucellosis flared up after the end of the socialist period as a preventable disease. Under socialist rule, brucellosis was relatively well controlled. And the World Health Organization asked us if it was profitable to mass vaccinate 25 million sheep, goat and cattle to prevent human brucellosis. And similarly to the rabies example, we developed an animal-human mathematical transmission model between sheep, between cattle, and from sheep and cattle to humans, and simulated with the estimated the parameters the effect of mass vaccination on the production and health cost. And the summary of this is here. For about $8 million intervention cost for a 10-year mass vaccination scheme, the public health benefits are only about $3 million. So if you are a minister of health, your conclusion would be, it's not profitable, we don't do it. But we asked about 250 patients, brucellosis patients, about their private health cost and income loss, that's shown here. And we simulated with a matrix model of livestock production the effect of brucellosis on livestock productivity and production. And if you bring all these benefits together, you see that this is 3 times higher than the intervention cost. And here is again the added value of a One Health assessment, of a cross-sector economic assessment, that you can show that an intervention at the source is profitable from a societal perspective, while from a pure public health perspective it is not. Many people tell me, these things are good in Africa and Asia and developing countries, but that's not for industrialized countries. But I completely disagree. I think there is a huge potential for One Health in industrialized countries. This is a publicity of the Calgary Vet School and Med School in the Toronto airport. And that's a nice thing. The Canadians are really very advanced in Calgary, having the Vet School and the Med School on the same campus and having also joint appointments. Bonnie Bantaine wrote a chapter on the academic development for One Health in that book that we are bringing out. And Canada is good also in their Winnipeg laboratory, where you have the high security tracts for highly contagious disease for animals and humans under the same roof. And a conservative back-on-the-envelope estimate of the World Bank estimates about a 26% saving in operations cost from having these labs together. And in Switzerland, we have just built a P4 high-security lab just for humans. And I would argue we could have saved a lot of money by just joining it with our own animal high-security lab. Anyway, there is a big potential, not only in these institutional aspects, but very much also in communication. Doctors and veterinarians also don't communicate in industrialized countries. That's a well-known fact. And I keep continuing with Canadian praise. Canada has also this integrated program for antimicrobial resistance surveillance, where the surveillance of antibiotic resistance is totally integrated between humans and animals and the environment. And here, actually, we can open to the eco-health because they include already the environment. And you see also this complicated schematic where with all these arrows, we start touching complexity. We start touching complexity science, and we can finally link to the eco-health. I personally think that One Health is embedded in EcoHealth. It is not separated. And I'm against another association of One Health. I think we can happily be part of the EcoHealth movement because the advantage of EcoHealth is to extend the equation to include the ecosystem. And I must say that, of course, as the president of the association. And again, I happily invite you to become members. Just one example, I mean this mercury poisoning of fish in the Amazon, which was first related to upstream gold mining, could not be substantiated. Only when in an ecological study it was shown that around that area there was a huge deforestation and the soil was bare and the naturally occurring mercury in the soil was just washed out and eaten, taken up by the fish, and predatory fish accumulated it even more. So the ultimate source of human contamination of mercury was actually the deforestation. I think we could extend examples widely, but I stop here about that. But clearly I see that One Health is embedded in wider ecological thinking, in a wider thinking of health in social ecological systems. And here I would also see a very important role for New Zealand and for New Zealand scientists. I see this enormous engagement of Otago, and I'm also happy to have Margot Parks here, who is an Otago trained scholar, who was the second president of the EcoHealth Association, and she was also instrumental in the foundation of this Oceania chapter. And I see also this fantastic engagement of Massey University in One Health. So I think you have all the ingredients for a strong One Health leadership, not only in New Zealand, but in the world. And of course, again, we would be very happy if your institutions could also become partners of the association. As outlook, I would like to go back to our book and also go back to the philosophical basis. What I deplore today is very much is that our students don't longer have philosophy in their curriculum. Recently, I asked my students if they knew what were the philosophical foundations of the rationalist and empirist approaches they are going to choose for their PhDs. No one could name me Descartes. So our students lack the fundamental understanding of the philosophical basis of the way we think today in natural science. And we were very happy to have the Canadian philosopher Karen Hull to write a chapter there she relates very much to Spinoza also, and emphasizes that we need this philosophical reflection on health, because we need also a healthy way to think about our health. And we have seen this also earlier today in the relation to Maori medicine. We need to relate back to the spiritual and moral dimension of health in our thinking. And we could also motivate Martin Bunch and David Waldner Taves to contribute a chapter on post-normal science. And I just cite here that example that Margot also mentioned already, that we should see health not in isolation. We should see health in relation to livelihoods, to food production, to the social reality of a community, and in this complex interaction, identify what are the best choices we can make for health. And a field that is mostly dear to me is we should not remain just contemplative in our work. We should contribute to fill the no-do gap. If we would apply today all what we know already, we could increase health probably by 60%. There is a massive gap, and it was nicely presented again today. Most of these maternal health issues are not issues of lack of knowledge. Everything is known, but we must apply it. So we advocate strongly a science of disease elimination. Of course, we need new vaccines and we need new antibiotics, but we need also a science that applies it and find out what are the barriers to effectively apply it. I have written this commentary in the Journal of Infectious Disease of Poverty about the science of rabies elimination. I would like to close my talk with this picture, which is from that area in North Mali where we can no longer go. First of all, it shows almost an idealistic situation. You know, these pictures of Josef and Maria on Christmas Day. It's a young mother and her baby, and the man to the right is a medical doctor, a young Malian doctor, and he helped us to do this work. These people live in a very, very harsh environment. You and I would not survive a week there. But these people are environmental experts. They can survive on their own in such a harsh climate together with their animals in a mutual interdependence. But all this is very, very fragile. And this is also why I choose this picture, because also our planet is fragile. And if we don't take care actually on the ecological dimension of working on health, we can risk serious damage. And I keep these pictures as a metaphor for this fragile environment for which we have to take care in relation to taking care of the health of the animals in the background and, of course, of the people in the forefront. Thank you very much for your attention.